Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 42, featuring my conversation with Mohamed Sidibe, a former child soldier from Sierra Leone who is now a peace activist and an advocate for human rights. Mohamed tells the story of his abduction by the Revolutionary United Front and the 4.5 brutal years he spent in their captivity. He also explains how he ultimately overcame the hardships of his past, immigrated to America, and now studies law at Fordham University in New York City. Mohamed's journey is one of healing and hope that will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Between 1991 and 2002, the West African country, Sierra Leone, was in the midst of a bloody civil war. Anti-government forces led by the Revolutionary United Front, the RUF, ravaged villages across the country, killing adults, raping women, and forcing young boys to take up arms. The United Nations estimates that roughly 10,000 boys under the age of 18 were forced to be combatants in the conflict, where adult soldiers use alcohol and drugs to manipulate these boys and train them to kill. Our guest today, Mohamed Sidibe, was only 5 years old when the RUF raided his small village, killed all of his family members, and initiated him into the rebel forces. Before he had even learned his ABCs, he was forced to wield an AK-47 in bloody battles across his country. In our conversation today, Mohamed courageously takes us back to that painful period. He tells us of his attempted escape from the RUF camp and his subsequent struggle as a homeless orphan on the streets of Freetown after the war ended. He also recounts how he learned to educate himself, what it was like immigrating to America as a teen, and now he finally learned to smile again. I had the privilege of meeting Mohamed years ago through the My Hero Project, an incredible organization that uses media, art, and technology to celebrate the best of humanity. I was so impressed by Mohamed's character and achievements that we invited him to attend one of our institutes to become a Freedom Writer teacher. We're so proud to have him as a beloved member of our family. At the time of this recording, Mohamed had just returned from speaking at the United Nations, not to mention his recent trip to a detention center at the U.S.-Mexico border, where he provided legal assistance to women and children seeking asylum here in the United States. Mohamed's story is an enduring example of transforming the pain of your past into the purpose of your present. Without further ado, here is my inspiring conversation with human rights leader and peace activist, Mohamed Sidibe. I wish our audience could see the most beautiful face that I am sitting across from. Radiant and full of joy and full of life. And how I met this amazing young man was a storytelling event that was very painful and heart-wrenching about that beautiful smile being safely guarded. So, Mohamed, what I'd like to do is I'd like to take our listeners back to your childhood in Sierra Leone, and I want you to paint a picture before the war, before the problems, when you were that beautiful, joyous, happy young boy with stuffed animals in hand and a loving mother who just loved on her boy.
I grew up running. I love to run. So I ran everywhere. I ran when I was chasing my friends and when I was in trouble. And wherever I had to go, I ran. It was a small town, a village. And I knew nothing of the world and about the world beyond that which I lived in. It was not a place where people dreamed of being doctors, lawyers, or scientists. But it was a place where people were, they were happy with the little that they had. And I didn't grow up wanting. I grew up feeling satisfied because everything that I know of and about the world was in that little village that I grew up in.
And I love when you're talking about that beautiful village, the smile, the dimples, the simplicity and the joy. And then things weren't so simple and things weren't so joyful. So what happened to that beautiful village that gave you everything you wanted?
The war came. When the rebels came, everything was in chaos. These are people who never thought the war was going to come where they lived. They won't worry about it. We're isolated. We don't have to worry. And so they weren't prepared. People ran. And I still vividly remember the RUF screaming, telling people not to run as they continued to shoot. Most of the people who they took were kids. And most of the older people were killed. I never understood why they killed adults and took children. And
specifically boys? Did they take young women as well? No,
they took girls. The interesting thing is, like, most of us, like the ones that they took, we were really young boys. But then the girls were teenagers. They tend to take most of the teenage girls, but they didn't take girls as young as boys. I later realized why that was, but then I didn't really know why it was. I only took all of the boys my age and older who weren't too old, and the girls who weren't too young or who weren't as young as I was.
Let's stay in that moment for a moment. You're 5 years old, devastated, and clearly didn't understand what post-traumatic stress disorder was or trauma. And can you talk about those first few moments of missing and wanting and longing and not having a mother to hold you and tell you everything was going to be okay?
The worst part about that was how, on that particular day, I was forced to grow up. I saw my entire family being murdered in front of me. And I was taken from my village. I got put in the back of an SUV, was driven with other children. I wanted to go back. I wanted to go back home. But what I didn't realize is there was no home to go back to, because not only had I witnessed the murder of my entire family, the town was on fire. But there was this tiny bit of memory I still remember. People, me running around, me being chased by my friends. We arrived not too far away. And I remember waking up to this stench of alcoholic breath and people smoking and people who looked absolutely normal. When I looked at them, it wasn't like the faces that I was looking at were the faces of Satan or evil men or who have killed my parents. I was looking at men. And, like, you know, there was nothing more. And I wanted to go home. But I still remember what one of the commanders then, or my captors, said, "We are family. But in our family, we do not forgive. And we do not forget."
So the manipulation and brainwashing started on day one.
Yep. The way they trained we were forced to watch Rambo, the movie. And then the commander, so like, that's the soldiers that we want. Those are the soldiers that we expect you to be. There's this thing called Brown, which is a mixture of gunpowder and cocaine. And everyone took it.
As a five-year-old child, they were giving you cocaine.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of didn't feel like it was unnatural. To them, it felt completely natural. And they tied people's eyes and it made us shoot in the distance. And when the blindfolds were removed, we all saw the holes that our bullet has pierced. But no one knew what their role was in the lifeless bodies that lay there, because no one knew who was responsible. You were told to do something, and you do it. And that's exactly how I lived my life. Whatever I was told to do, I do it. Because make no mistake, there are consequences when you don't.
And as a five-year-old child, and that's really what you were, a child, holding this heavy equipment, what did that feel like? It must have been surreal and scary and daunting.
I just wanted to go home. And I thought I was going to go home for a very long time from that first day. I thought I was going to go home. That despite everything that I had seen, I still thought that there was still a home to go to. I still thought that everything I had just witnessed was a nightmare. And that when I decided to run and decided to go home, that I was going to get home and that someone was going to tell me I was late for dinner, or that someone was going to tell me I was late for something, but that would be all. And it quickly started to sink in that maybe this is going to be my new reality. So I ran, because home was still very much so visible in my head.
When you talk about your childhood, the first thing you said was running, that you ran for joy when you were in a good mood or a bad mood. So for our listeners, explain what it was like to run and what happened as you were running.
I remember saying, like, I was going to use the bathroom. I mean, we didn't have bathrooms. You just go to the farthest somewhere in the bush and relieve yourself. What I didn't realize was that when I said I was going to go to the bathroom, at the very most, that was only going to get me a half an hour head start. And so I decided to just start walking. And then there was this vast river in front of me. There was no way I could get in because the sheer force of the river was, I was no match for it. And so I stood there thinking that maybe I could fly. I grew up believing in magic, and I wanted to disappear and appear on the other end. And it quickly began to register to me how much trouble I was in when the footsteps started to become louder and the voices started to get more closer and closer. And I remember being hit with the back end of the AK-47. I think at this point, the memories of my present, the present that I was living in, had overshadowed the memory that I was holding on to, this idea of home. I had begun to see that there was nothing to go back to.
Were you forced to harden your heart? Were you forced to be numb?
It wasn't so much so that you're forced to be numb that you just become. What I learned to do is to be small so much to the point that I am there physically, but no one would ever look at me. No one would ever know that I'm there. Because when someone notices you, you are in trouble. The hardest part for me was just this idea that when I thought of running, I associated running with the footsteps that I heard chasing me. That I no longer wished to play hide and seek. All I wanted to do was just be there and make myself as small as possible.
My heart is aching because I wish everyone could see you today. You are anything but small. I think when I associate you, I see this smile, these dimples, this joy. You actually radiate. You are actually larger than life. You are actually 10 feet tall in my eyes. I've seen you on stages. I've seen you in tuxedos. I've seen you with dignitaries. And I hate that someone tried to take away the very essence of that light, because you do light up a room. And so in that very dark place, what was that like each and every day to be in the light, to be in Africa, but be surrounded by such darkness?
From the day that I tried to run, I no longer thought that there was good in the world. I no longer thought that there was light. I forgot that I was once a happy child. I didn't know how unhappy I was. So when I look back at some of the pictures that were taken of me after the war, I did not smile in a single one of them. And this is after the war ended. I really forgot how to smile, because I guess smile makes people human. And, well, at that time, I don't think I thought there was any good in the world. Your best friend at 2 p.m. will kill you at 2:01 p.m. because their life depended on it. We weren't encouraged to form relationships or create bonds. We were there to fight for something that we didn't know about.
What I love about your heroic story is you have so much gumption and so much grit and so much determination. So at 9.5 years old, after 4.5 years of being numb, the war ends.
Yes.
And for a young boy who never went to school, for a young boy who was never taught to read or write, and the irony is now you speak multiple languages fluently and beautifully and so eloquently. But at 9.5 years old, without a home, without a mother, without a village, and all of this trauma, you have to learn to be a child and go to school. Tell our listeners about what a 9.5-year-old boy does the second they have freedom.
I wish I can tell the story of how when the war ended, everything was amazing, because it wasn't. The best part that I now realize that I did not realize back then was what UNICEF did for me. I got put in a home by Red Cross through groups of people who had the same last name that I had in the slum. And then we quickly realized that we weren't related besides having the same last name. But a couple of months after the war ended and after I was brought to the city through the help of various international organizations, I found myself homeless in Freetown. And I began to wonder, for 4.5 years of my life, there was some sense of structure where I wasn't supposed to think for myself. There's nothing that I did that was for me or about me. And now I had to become an adult in a different sense.
Resourceful. Where am I going to sleep today? What am I going to eat today?
Yes. And I quickly learned how to swim. I learned how to fish, and I learned how to survive. But what made a difference was the fact that what UNICEF did to send me to school. Arriving in school and realizing that I was in a grade where everyone was a lot younger than I was, and they understood the material a lot better than I did. I wish I could tell you that I kept going to school because I loved to learn. That will just be a lie. But the only reason why I kept going back to school was because it's a part of me that felt a little safe. That for a couple of hours out of the day, I didn't have to run around. I just have to sit in the classroom and just be there.
For all of us that know you, there's an American book that's treasured by kids, and it's called Where's Waldo? And it's the adventures of this kid. And I feel like your life is a Where's Waldo now. I kid you not. I never know which continent you're on. I never know which country you're on. I never know which international aid group you are currently working with. So when I think about you, you are this sophisticated world traveler who literally travels the globe. And when we first sat down, you were telling me all the places you're headed. What I love about what you did when you started learning was you became your own educator. You became your own teacher. So tell our listeners what Muhammad did with computers and what Muhammad did with maps and how Muhammad realized, I am going to go to America.
I went to school in the slum. And when I say school, that is a very generous way of putting it. I wasn't expected to read a book or analyze a book. I was taught for the life that I was already living. I wasn't taught for the future. I remember when I first got to the center, all the kids were very excited to talk to the program director, who was called Andrew Green at that time. And I just didn't want to talk to anyone. I just wanted to, there's this computer game called Dave. And I just wanted to play that game and not really talk to anyone at all. I didn't like people. And I was still distrustful of everything and of everyone around me. And there's still this part of me that felt and believed like everyone was going to leave me.
So I'll push them away before they pull me closer.
I just avoided them. But I remember when I learned, you know, like about the U.S. or about Canada through these pen pal emails that you will send. That was always the best part. I went to that center like 3 or 4 days a week or whenever I could. I went. I still never thought that I could ever leave Sierra Leone. And I mean, up to this day, me leaving Sierra Leone was like, if I often use one word, it was serendipitous.
That's a great word.
But serendipity is the only thing that I could use to explain how I left Sierra Leone and why I left Sierra Leone.
I've been blessed to meet the most important people in your life.
Yes.
And they all have the same things to say about you. First, they are in awe and they marvel. But they all realize that you are the master of your own destiny, that you are the embodiment of like a carpe diem, that you make things happen. So explain to our listeners, those young kids in classrooms or at their homes who dream of escaping, who don't want to talk to anybody, who realize this can't be it for me. I don't think you ever lost the belief in magic or flying, because your life is magical and you fly everywhere. So tell us about that first flight where you left the slums of Freetown.
Yeah.
And you believed in magic again.
Well, when I got invited to come to the U.S. and I arrived in April 2007, everything felt different. The first week in the U.S. was everything I had imagined it to be and more.
And you said you were invited. So for our listeners, how does a young former child soldier get an invitation to come to America?
This organization, the Iron Organization that I was part of, who was mainly an organization for like homeless children, former child soldiers, and youth. Their parent organization here in the U.S., a student of theirs went to Kenyon College. And so they were doing this project called, I think, Children Caught in Crossfire. And so they invited a director of the program to come speak. And they asked the director of the program if he could bring someone with experience. Hence, when I use the word serendipity, I was somehow amongst all of the other people he decided to ask me to come. And so that's how I came. And, you know, we arrived in New York. We didn't leave New York. We just went straight to Ohio. And it was in Ohio, again, that America, that I realized I too could go to college. It was something I never really dreamt of. I wanted to be somebody, but I just never knew how I was going to be that person. And so the America that I was first welcomed to the first week was not the America that subsequently followed.
I want to focus in on two dramatically opposed thoughts of being small,
yeah,
and then being somebody. Oh my God, that just makes me want to weep when you kept repeating, I had to be small, I wanted to be small, I had to be small. And then there's this light inside of you that's, I can be somebody.
Yeah.
What was that like the first time you realized, I can be somebody?
See, the education that I had received in Sierra Leone did not adequately prepare me for a life outside of the slum. And I was all of a sudden find myself for the first time receiving proper learning at 14 in American high school, people who've been going to school half of their lives.
And I was expected to read and write a report.
So you had a crash course at 14 with 14-year-old Americans.
Yeah.
You'd really only had less than 4 years of school at that point. And you're now an exchange student.
Not an exchange, because I was here to stay. I found a home, and then like I moved to New Jersey, and I started the quintessential like suburban, town. And so like I started school at, Columbia High School. But it was a completely phenomenal experience. Just being there. I just found the whole American school system so weird and so different. But the hardest part for me was people knew how to read text, how to like analyze and think about things that they've read. I wasn't taught how to do that. And so for me, that was a learning experience. It was a steep learning curve. But I think it was after I survived that, after this, I lived in a place where going to college was a norm. Everyone is practically expected to go to college. Everyone talked about college. People graduated and for the most part went to university. So I realized this could actually happen.
The irony is that we are in the middle of Manhattan. We're at Fordham University's law school. And I want to paint a picture for our audience of a day in the life of Mohammed. This morning started off, you were dressed to the nines in a beautiful suit because this morning you were testifying to the United Nations.
Yes.
In a few days, you're going to be going to UNESCO in Europe, fighting for the rights of others. And you literally just returned from the Texas border as a legal scholar, helping young people and their mothers who are detained learn, understand their rights. And I'm still fixated on this 5-year-old child who doesn't run, who doesn't feel, who doesn't smile. How and when did you learn to smile again?
The beginning of my American experience was not what I had hoped for it to be, because I found myself homeless in a country where I did not know homelessness existed, a country where I knew neither the language, culture. But I started smiling when I moved to America. I cannot sit here and tell you that this was the moment that I realized I could smile again. If anything, I think it happened gradually as I became more comfortable and I started to realize that there is good and bad in the world. There is light. And I started to smile again.
What also happened for you is a nurturing,
yes,
loving home.
Oh, yes.
For a boy who was always in search of home.
Yep.
So what was that like to have home-cooked meals and smiles and holidays and everything that you did not have for the first 14 years of your life, or actually from 5 to 14? So for 9 years, you didn't have any of that. What was that like to get it back?
For the majority of the time, I attribute everything that I became to education and to luck. The reality is, if I didn't have the home that I had when I moved to this country, if I had gone through the normal foster care process, I probably would have disappeared in the system. I lived in a home with a lovely family, my family, where I didn't have to think about food, where at some point I think I became sort of Americanized. Like I opened the fridge and there's a lot of food and I'll still think about ordering Chinese food and we'll still order Chinese food, me and my friends. And that sort of like became the norm. But it wasn't something that I ever thought of. It was only after I graduated I realized like I was only able to achieve everything that I achieved because I had a home, I had food, like I had everything that I needed and things that I wanted that allowed me to be a kid.
And even more so for young American students who don't have to worry about going to the bathroom in the bushes like you did when you were a child soldier. Having shoes that properly fit.
Yes.
Having a blanket and a bed when you sleep. I mean, think about
having your own room.
Your own room. Everything that you had from 14 on is diametrically opposed to what you experienced in Sierra Leone. You were devoid of everything, every worldly possession. What was the one thing you coveted the most? Was it shoes? Because you're wearing the best shoes right now. Was it shoes? Was it a bed? What was the one thing or things that you think, even to this day, that you don't take for granted?
Bed and food. Actually, I do sometimes forget to eat.
I brought you the biggest dinner, and I think you're going to covet it for 3 days. But I love watching you eat your dinner tonight because it's like, I'll save it. Yeah. I'll save it for later. Was that something you think you learned as a kid?
Yeah. I mean, like, the idea of just, like, saving, because you never really know when you're going to get it. So it's a habit. I mean, like, I love to eat. I love food. But when it's not in front of me, I don't think about it. Probably not healthy for me. They're just like, well, I'm going to do something else. And so when I have it, I'm like, okay, I'm going to save this for, like, later. But most important thing for me was a bed. Remember, like, the first time I had a bed that was my own. I had just moved in with my family now, and I had a twin-size bed. And I remember, like, because Arsenal was, like, my favorite team, and my room was painted with the Arsenal colors, and then I had the Arsenal the posters on the wall. And I arrived, it was as if, like, my family knew everything that I wanted. Because I remember, like, we went out, we had dinner, and then they were, asking me all these questions and then everything else. And then I was just like, I didn't know. I just kept answering them, and I arrived, and, like, everything was, like, was used, like, that's how they figure out, like, my favorite team and everything. At that point, like, yes, I had slept on beds, because, I mean, I didn't really sleep on a proper bed until I moved to the U.S. But these are, like, they're either beds in a hotel on a college campus or a bed at a motel. It felt very transient. But there's, like, I laid down, and it was just like,
these are my sheets.
These are my sheets.
These are my pillows.
And I remember, like, my mom walked in, like, the next morning, and it's like, my bed was, like, perfectly made because I like, slept on top of it. And then, of course, eventually I got into the, now I wake up, I was like, I just pulled the sheets over. I'm like, okay, there I go, cover the bed. But I still remember I slept on the sheets that night. I didn't even sleep under the sheets, but it was just, there's something about it that was, like, so magical. This idea that I was in my own room. I had my own room for the first time, and I was sleeping on a bed for the first time in my life. That was my own bed.
I've met your American mother.
Yeah.
And what I love about your American mother is she pays such homage and reverence to your biological mother. Yeah. She never wanted to replace her. She always wants you to remember her.
Yeah.
So what is it like to have enough love in your heart to have the memory of your mother and this new adopted mother who loves you as her son?
It's such a great feeling because my family taught me how to love again, how to smile, and gave me a sense of security. They taught me things that has now imbued me with the duty and responsibility to question and challenge institutions that weren't built with people like me, or challenge ideologies that are completely opposed to my way of life and the way of lives of many other people who come from different parts of the world. My family's a very political family, and this is going to be my first election where I actually get to vote. So I'm so excited, about exercising this. But I remember, we always talk about, like, what my first voting experience was going to be like, and it couldn't be at a more opportune time.
I want to talk about a painful reality that we don't often discuss on the news. They came to your village, and it was rape, pillage, and burn. And they took the young boys to be soldiers, and presumably the teenage girls to be sexualized, objectified, and raped.
Yeah.
And when you went to the border, I'm sure a lot of these women in that trek from whatever country, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, wherever they're leaving, many of these courageous women had to face that same objectification and sexualization on their journey here.
Yeah.
Did that allow you, when you sat beside these women, to have great empathy and compassion for their journey and their victimization of a different sort? You were beat with guns and stomped on. These women were beat in a very different way. Did that allow you to sit with them and understand their story?
When someone exerts their power over you, they try to take your agency. When you talk to these women and you realize and you can hear in their voices how strong and resilient they are, there is this famous poem, Invictus. It reminds you of that.
For listeners who don't know that incredible poem, and I know that Mandela invoked it in South Africa upon freedom.
Yes.
Can you recite this poem, Invictus?
Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeoning of chance, my head is bloody, but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horrors of the shade. And yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my faith. I am the captain of my soul. Talking to these women who refuse to have their dignity taken away from them, it just makes you believe that we all go through a crucible. How we come out, on the other hand, however, is sometimes things that we can explain and sometimes things that we just cannot explain. And all of these women have gone through a crucible. And the fact that they're coming out on the other hand, stumbling, but still unafraid, tells you something about resilience.
So I met you.
Yep.
As a teacher, you met me as a Miss G.
Yep.
And I have tried to give you a homework assignment from the day I met you, and that was Muhammad. Write what needs to be written. There is a story that needs to be picked up by a young boy in a class who can read your words and say, I look like him and I talk like him and I want to be somebody. There's a child who feels small. There's a child who's alone. So until my dying breath, I'm going to keep giving you that homework assignment because that book needs to be written for someone who is anything but small, anyone from that comes from a place that's not simple. So if you were to envision that very first chapter that we're gonna actualize it on this very podcast.
Okay.
That first chapter about that boy who ran, that boy who could fly, that boy that believed in magic, what would that first chapter of the book that you're going to write for that boy in the corner who needs to read those words?
I would write about how I believed in magic and how, not because of anything that I did, but because of where I was born and the time in which I was born, that magic was stolen from me. And I would write about how I got it back, and how long it took me to get it back.
I'm so grateful to Muhammad for sharing his story with us. My dear listeners, may we remember that there is always light despite the darkness. May we use our voices to advocate for those less fortunate than ourselves. And as our guest Muhammad Sidibe so heroically exemplifies, may we all become masters of our own fate. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and thank you for being a part of our Freedom Rider family. If you'd like to learn more about Muhammad and the work he has done with United Nations or the My Hero Project, please go to the episode's description in your podcast app and click on the link in our show notes. Once again, I'm your host, Aaron Gruo. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.